You know, when most of us picture extreme wealth, we usually imagine something out of a classic cartoon.
Oh, yeah. The giant reinforced steel vault.
Right, exactly. Filled to the brim with gold coins, where a billionaire just dives into this, like,
Yeah.
pool of static accumulated cash.
It is. I mean, it's the ultimate visual shorthand for being rich. You just hoard a giant mountain of money and lock the door.
But when you actually look at the mechanics of modern extreme wealth, that vault is completely empty.
Totally empty. Yeah.
The money isn't sitting in a room. It's woven into the very fabric of how you live your life. So today we are unpacking this massive, incredibly detailed intelligence briefing. It was compiled by the American newspaper and American TV.
And it is a fascinating document.
It really is. We are looking at a comprehensive snapshot of America's richest people captured on June 8, 2026. And the mission for our deep dive today is to really decode the true nature of this modern extreme wealth. So, okay, let's unpack this, because the top of this wealth table is no longer just a list of rich individuals. It is quite literally a map of modern industrial power.
Yeah. The foundational thesis of this entire briefing is that America's richest people do not get there by collecting a massive salary. I mean, no matter how high that salary might be.
Which is how most people think about getting rich, right?
Right?
A bigger paycheck.
Exactly. But they are rich because they own and control the foundational infrastructure of modern life. We're talking about, computation, AI architecture, global logistics, search algorithms, and capital markets.
The actual plumbing.
Right, the plumbing. You aren't just looking at wealthy people. You are looking at the architects and landlords of the digital and physical plumbing you use every single day.
And the sheer scale of it is almost hard to comprehend. I mean, let's look at the big reveal from this June 2026 snapshot. Sitting at the absolute top with a staggering estimated net worth of $825.7 billion is Elon Musk.
It is a frankly astronomical figure, and it's fueled by his equity in Tesla, SpaceX, XAI, and X. But the real underlying story here is the gap between him and the rest of the field.
It's the chasm.
It really is. The next tier down features Larry Page at $299.9 billion and Larry Ellison at $295.4 billion.
Wow.
Musk is nearly $500 billion ahead of second place.
That is just wild to think about. But what really jumps out at me looking at the top 15 names on this list is that it basically reads like a tech director.
Much so.
The dominant theme, like the reason these numbers have exploded so violently in this 2025 to 2026 window, is the massive surge in artificial intelligence and cloud computing. But I guess my question is, why is tech dominating so heavily compared to, say, manufacturing or real estate or oil?
Well, it comes down to the mechanics of scale and marginal cost. So if you want to build a physical car factory, building a second one costs almost as much as the first.
Right, you need materials.
Yeah. You have to buy land, pour concrete, hire thousands of workers, source steel, all of that. But software, microchips, and cloud platforms have a totally different economic reality.
Because it's digital.
Exactly. Once you build an AI recommendation engine, serving the next million users costs fractions of a cent. Tech platforms scale globally almost instantly.
That makes
And
sense.
when you combine those incredible growth margins with unusually strong founder ownership, you get this explosive wealth generation machine.
So owning this kind of wealth isn't like having that Scrooge McDuck vault of gold coins. It's more like holding the deed to the city's water supply.
Yes, or the municipal power grid.
Right. Everyone has to pay you a toll just to run their lives. Like, you need their cloud servers to run your small business, their chips to train your software, their logistics networks to get your groceries delivered.
You are interacting with their equity every single time you touch your smartphone or order a package online. And what's crucial to understand here is that even the non-tech billionaires on this list fit this exact same structural model.
Oh, really? Like
Yeah.
who?
Well, they own monopoly-like choke points, too. Look at the Waltons. Rob, Jim, and Alice Walton are sitting around $120 to $130 billion each.
And people just think of them as owning grocery stores.
Right, physical stores with cash registers. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, over decades, they built and expanded a massive retail logistics, supply chain, and global distribution engine.
Ah, I see.
Walmart is essentially a cash-generating toll bridge for consumer goods. It's a logistical platform that dictates how physical products move across the entire world.
Okay, that makes total sense. And Michael Bloomberg, who is sitting at $109.4 billion.
Yeah, he owns the Bloomberg Terminal. It is the information and data infrastructure for the entire global financial industry.
So you literally can't do the job without it.
If you're trading at a high level, you cannot operate without one. It's a niche with incredibly high switching costs, meaning once a bank installs Bloomberg Terminals, they are virtually locked into paying that subscription forever.
Wow. Okay, then you have Warren Buffett at $139.7 billion.
Buffett is the ultimate example in the financial sector. He controls Berkshire Hathaway, which at its core operates as a massive insurance float and an asset compounding engine.
Wait, let's pause and look under the hood of how an insurance company actually works for a second, because float is one of those financial terms that gets thrown around a lot.
It does, yeah.
For anyone who hasn't looked into it, float is basically money that customers have paid in insurance premiums but hasn't been paid out in claims yet. So if I pay my car insurance every month, that money sits in a giant pool waiting for someone to get into an accident.
And while that money is sitting there, Buffett gets to take that giant pool of quote-unquote not his money and invest it in other companies.
That is brilliant.
It's essentially a massive zero-interest loan from the public that never really comes due because new premiums are always coming in to replace the claims being paid out. Berkshire Hathaway is an infrastructure for capturing and reallocating capital.
Okay, so we've established what they own, these massive scalable toll bridges. But if they own the plumbing, how do we put a dollar figure on it? Because I feel like this is where the public gets deeply confused by the headlines.
Oh, absolutely.
We read that someone is worth $200 billion, and we inherently imagine a bank account with $200 billion sitting in it, ready to be spent on yachts or islands or whatever.
And what's fascinating here is that this raises an important question about the illusion of modern wealth. The methodology of this Forbes real-time list makes it abundantly clear. These net worths are just mark-to-market approximations.
Meaning, they are just taking whatever the last single share traded for on the open stock market and multiplying by the total number of shares the founder holds.
Exactly that simple. And exactly that volatile. At this level, wealth is highly volatile, unrealized equity. It is not cash.
Right.
A 5% swing in the stock price of a company like Nvidia or Oracle can literally move a single person's fortune by tens of billions of dollars before you've even finished your morning coffee.
That is mind-boggling. I mean, let's look at Jensen Huang, the CEO of Nvidia. According to the snapshot, he is worth $194.5 billion. But the briefing points out he only owns about 3% of Nvidia.
A 3% stake sounds almost negligible for a founder, right?
Yeah, it does.
But his wealth is entirely dependent on market sentiment and valuation multiples. When we talk about a valuation multiple, we're talking about how much investors are willing to pay today for a dollar of future profit.
Got it.
Because the public market has decided that NVIDIA's chips are the core infrastructure hardware for the entire artificial intelligence revolution, investors are willing to pay an astronomical premium. His net worth is a direct reflection of global AI capital expenditures.
CapEx, right. The billions and billions of dollars that other companies like Microsoft, Google, and Meta are spending to build out massive physical server farms.
Precisely.
As long as they keep buying chips, NVIDIA's multiple stays sky high, and Wong's 3% slice is worth nearly $200 billion.
Now contrast that with Larry Ellison at Oracle. He owns over 40% of the company.
Wow, 40%.
Yeah. Because his ownership percentage is so incredibly concentrated, his wealth is hypersensitive to Oracle's aggressive pivot into AI data centers, as well as their internal financial engineering. Oracle runs massive stock buyback programs.
Which is where the company uses its own profits to buy its own shares off the open market and retire them.
Which means there are fewer slices of the pie available. The company buys back stock, the price goes up, and Ellison's 40% stake becomes astronomically more valuable without him selling a single thing or altering his day-to-day operations.
Okay, but let me push back on this for a second.
Sure.
If this wealth is all just paper, I mean, if it's entirely reliant on public market sentiment, shifting multiples, and the hype cycle of other tech companies buying server space, are these rankings even real?
That is the big question.
Isn't this just an illusion? Like, a list of who is most exposed to a potential AI CapEx bubble right now.
The briefing validates that exact pushback. This is precisely the vulnerability of this kind of wealth. The source explicitly lists an AI CapEx bubble risk as the primary vulnerability for Jensen Huang.
Wow, really?
Yes. And for the rest of the tech billionaires, the main threat is listed as public market valuation compression.
Okay, so if Wall Street cools off.
If Wall Street suddenly decides AI isn't going to generate the expected returns, the massive spending stops, the multiples compress, hundreds of billions of dollars of perceived wealth will simply evaporate into thin air.
Just gone.
Gone. This list is a live index of market optimism just as much as it is a measure of historical business success.
So if your wealth is that volatile and it's tied entirely to the mood swings of the public markets, what happens when Wall Street panics? I mean, if I own shares in a public company and the CEO makes a bad bet that loses half its value, the board of directors is going to force them out.
Right.
How do these figures maintain their iron grip on their empires if they only own a fraction of the stock?
Well, the founders of these platforms recognized a structural problem early on. They couldn't fund global expansion without selling off massive pieces of their companies to the public. They needed Wall Street's money.
Sure.
But they absolutely refused to give up control to Wall Street's whims.
Which introduces one of the most fascinating mechanisms of modern corporate power.
Yeah.
The distinction between economic ownership and voting control. We're talking about dual class shares.
Yeah. When these tech giants went public, they essentially approached the market with an unprecedented proposition. They told investors, "We will take your capital, but we will not take your opinions."
And Wall Street just agreed.
Because the tech boom was so unbelievably lucrative, institutional investors just swallowed their pride and agreed to buy shares that carry little to no voting power.
Let's use Mark Zuckerberg as the prime example. He's sitting at $208.2 billion in this June 2026 snapshot. Over the years, he has sold off billions in stock to fund philanthropy and other ventures, right? Yeah. So he owns a much smaller economic slice of Meta than he used to.
Yeah.
But he holds absolute dictatorial power over the company.
He does this through Class B supervoting shares. In Meta's structural plumbing, every Class B share Zuckerberg holds gives him 10 votes, while the regular shares the public buys only get one vote.
10-1? That's crazy.
So his economic ownership might dip to 13 or 14%, but his voting power remains an unshakable majority. He can pivot the entire company toward a massive, multi-billion-dollar bet like building the metaverse or overhauling their AI infrastructure, and no activist hedge fund can fire him.
He is a public CEO with the job security of a private owner.
Exactly.
And it's not just him. Larry Page and Sergey Brin do the exact same thing at Alphabet, Google's parent company. They stepped back from the day-to-day operations years ago. They aren't in the office managing teams.
Right, they moved on to other things.
But they still hold majority voting control through their Class B shares, despite having a much smaller economic stake than they did at the IPO.
It acts as an invisible shield against outside pressure. And it's critical to note that this isn't just a Silicon Valley invention. Traditional wealth uses different legal structures to achieve the exact same governance lockdown.
Oh, like the Waltons again?
Exactly. Look back at the Waltons. They don't use dual-class tech shares. Instead, they coordinate their massive 35% stake in Walmart through legal entities like Walton Enterprises and the Walton Family Holdings Trust.
So instead of a dozen different cousins holding individual shares and potentially voting against each other or, you know, selling them off, they turn the family wealth into a single, coordinated, institutional block.
Right. It prevents the family's voting power from diluting as the wealth gets passed down through generations. The family operates as a unified corporate entity, ensuring they never lose control of the board.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. If you have total voting control, but only partial economic ownership, does that make you literally immune to normal business consequences?
Immune? No.
I mean, what happens when regular shareholders get furious about a decision? If you have 10 votes to their one, can you just ignore them?
You can ignore them on a strategic boardroom level, yes, but you aren't immune to consequences. The briefing includes a specific risk map pointing out that when voting control is locked down, the battleground simply shifts.
Shifts where?
The main counterbalances to this kind of entrenched control become legal and regulatory. You see massive shareholder lawsuits and compensation challenges in the courts.
Which we've seen extensively with Elon Musk.
We have. The briefing specifically cites the intense years-long litigation in the Delaware courts around Musk's Tesla governance and his compensation packages. When investors can't outvote a founder, their only recourse is to sue the board of directors for failing their fiduciary duty.
That structural reality, like the realization that you are untouchable in the boardroom but vulnerable in the courts and the legislature, that kind of explains the next evolution of this extreme wealth.
It's the logical next step.
Because once you control the modern infrastructure and you've locked down your voting power, the natural next step is turning that corporate dominance into societal and political influence.
The wealth eventually moves from simply growing a stock portfolio to actively defending the legal and regulatory systems that allow those monopolies to exist. Billionaire wealth today sits directly at the intersection of antitrust law, national security, and public speech.
Let's look at how this capital is actually deployed to shape the world we live in. Jeff Bezos is sitting at $266.7 billion. He owns the Washington Post, one of those influential political newspapers in the capital.
Right.
At the exact same time, Amazon is a massive federal contractor providing secure cloud computing services to defense and intelligence agencies.
And then consider Elon Musk, whose footprint spans from foundational defense infrastructure launching satellites with SpaceX and providing global internet via Starlink all the way to controlling the public square itself by owning X.
It's a massive span of influence.
When you control both defense logistics and global political communication, you aren't just a businessman anymore. You operate on the level of a geopolitical entity.
Now, the briefing highlights a very specific recent example of this shift from 2026. And looking at this purely structurally, you know, just following how the capital moves, it points to a major battle in California over a proposed billionaire taxation measure.
Right. And just to be clear to the listener, we are not taking a stance on the politics of this measure at all.
Oh, absolutely not. We are strictly neutrally reporting what's in the document. And the document notes that tech billionaires, including Google co-founder Sergey Brin, deployed heavy financial resources to campaign against it.
Right. And analyzing this strictly as a capital allocation strategy, it illustrates our point perfectly. When you amass $250 billion, your biggest risks are no longer competitors launching a slightly better app.
Yeah, that's not what keeps them up at night.
Your biggest risks are regulatory. You begin deploying capital to fund think tanks, election campaigns, or ballot measures that protect the legal environment, allowing your core infrastructure to function freely. It is simply a return on investment to protect the ecosystem.
And it isn't always sharp-elbowed political campaigns either. Sometimes that systemic influence is wielded through what we traditionally call charity. But even philanthropy at this level is about shaping global systems. It's rarely about just writing a check to a local food bank.
Philanthropy at the $100 billion scale is about building global policy institutions. It is about steering scientific research and public health priorities for entire continents.
Bill Gates is the prime example here. He is at $103.1 billion on this list. The briefing notes he has less than 1% of Microsoft left.
Barely any economic stake in the software company anymore.
Right. His wealth mechanism isn't really consumer technology anymore. It's his holding company, Cascade Investment, and the Gates Foundation. And the briefing highlights a staggering announcement from earlier in 2026. The Gates Foundation announced a mandate to pay out $9 billion annually with the explicit, intentional goal of closing the foundation entirely by 2045.
The logistics of deploying $9 billion a year into the global economy is just a massive undertaking. Gates is utilizing a systems thinking approach, pushing an enormous, concentrated wave of resources into science, technology, and health policy within a specific time horizon.
So it's not meant to last forever.
No, he isn't trying to build a perpetual institution. He is trying to permanently alter global health infrastructure before the middle of the century. It is the leading model of philanthropy functioning as a shadow global policy arm.
But not everyone does it that way. The briefing contrasts that massive bureaucratic Gates model with Musk's approach to legacy capital.
Yeah, the document describes Musk's foundation model as lean and episodic.
Episodic, that's an interesting way to put it.
It's highly centralized around the founder's immediate interests and doesn't rely on a heavy staff of policy experts. It is a completely different strategy, deploying capital in sudden bursts rather than sustaining a decades-long institutional rollout.
So what does this all actually mean? Let's synthesize the journey we've just been on. If there's one thing to take away from this 2026 intelligence snapshot, it's that being America's richest person has absolutely nothing to do with earning a high salary or saving your money.
Not at all. It is a distinct formula. It is about capturing concentrated equity in an asset early on. It is about building scalable digital or physical platforms that become the default infrastructure for everyone else's economic activity.
The toll bridges.
Exactly. It's about leveraging the public capital markets to achieve astronomical valuation multiples while ruthlessly locking down voting governance through dual class shares or trusts so you never lose the steering wheel.
For you listening, the next time you see a headline about a billionaire's net worth soaring by $20 billion in a week, Look beyond the celebrity of the individual. Look at the industrial structures they control.
That's the real story.
They aren't just rich people. They're the owners of the data layers, the retail networks, the cloud servers, and the AI chips that we all rely on to function.
They own the infrastructure. And their immense volatile wealth is simply the public market's daily assessment of how valuable that infrastructure is to the future of the global economy.
Which brings us back to that empty steel vault we talked about at the beginning. The gold coins aren't in a room. The wealth is the deed to the water supply. But if today's wealth is entirely a reflection of who owns the current foundational plumbing of our lives, well, what happens when this AI paradigm shifts? Who is currently sitting in a garage or a small lab building the invisible infrastructure of the 2030s? And how soon will they dethrone the people on this list, making their monopolies entirely obsolete? Something to think about the next time you log on.